Okay, great. So this is December 11th, 2013. I'm Rick Hansen, and happily, I did manage to record last week's talk, unlike the week before, and that talk summarized the week before it in terms of this series I'm doing on the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths, as you most likely know, are the truth of suffering. There is suffering, ranging from subtle to intense mental or physical discomfort, pain, or anguish. Then there is the truth of the cause of that suffering, which in the Buddha's model was summarized in a single word, craving, which I'll unpack a little bit. And then there is the third truth, the truth of the possibility of the ending of the cause of suffering, and therefore what the Buddha called the highest happiness, which is peace. And then there is the truth that there is a path which leads to the ending of the cause of suffering, that path having eight elements, the Noble Eightfold Path. That's the gist of the Four Noble Truths. They are offered not as dogma to believe in, it's not a faith doctrine, but rather as a roadmap and in some ways a hypothesis to be explored and examined in our own lives in terms of the evidence that we gather for ourselves. As the Buddha said repeatedly, ehi pasiko, that's Pali for see for yourself. Okay. So to date, what I've done is explored the first noble truth of suffering and distinguished between inevitable, inescapable physical and emotional pain and suffering that we add to various kinds of stimuli, including to pain, the suffering that is optional. In the saying that you may have heard, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. That's kind of the Dharma right there, of course, along with the famous Dr. Phil question. So, how's that working for you? All right, that's the essence of Buddhist practice. I'll also summarize probably in a single word, whatever. Okay, so I'm going to keep going here. All this said, so that's the suffering. That's the first noble truth. So then the question becomes, what's the distinction between inevitable pain and optional suffering, the suffering that is constructed? Well, in the Buddha's model, the distinction is between what he called tanha and chanda in Pali, the language of early Buddhism. Tanha being at root thirst or craving, that's what leads to suffering. Then there is wholesome desire, chanda, the wish that others be happy, the wish that others not suffer, the wish that we ourselves awaken, enjoy life, and have what the Buddha called that happiness visible in this present life. Those are wholesome desires. It's okay to have those desires. It's okay to respond to the ups and downs of life, the pleasant, the unpleasant, the heartfelt, and the neutral with wholesome desire without tipping into suffering and harm. So now we have this fundamental idea of craving. That's the English translation typically, rooted in a word, tanha, whose origins are thirst. So tonight I want to explore with you, what is this craving? What is this craving in our everyday lives that leads to suffering in ways large and small, suffering and harm for ourselves and others? And then I'll definitely open it up for some discussion here. So if you think about it, thirst, craving, is a drive state. It's based on an underlying sense of deficit or disturbance. There's a lack. There's something wrong. If you think of Maslow's hierarchy in terms of the five fundamental needs, right? The first four were called deficiency needs or D needs. The deficiency of safety, deficiency of power, deficiency of sexual opportunity, deficiency of prestige or standing, right? And then the final need for self-actualization is considered a B need. It's a being need. It's not based on an underlying sense of deficiency or deficit. Right? Drives are based on deficits or disturbances. That's a neuropsychological, biological way to understand this craving, this thirst, that is the primary source in the Buddhist model of our suffering, optional pain or discomfort, large and small. Okay? So where does this sense of deficit or disturbance come from? And the Buddha said basically there were three kinds of craving. There was the craving related to sense pleasures, the craving related to, if you will, stimuli, inner and outer stimuli of one kind or another. That's the kind of craving I'm going to explore tonight. It's the most obvious, grossest form of drivenness, if you will. The second kind of craving is a very interesting one, a craving that's kind of generic. I think of it as auto-craving or delusional craving. It's not based on any particular stimuli of any kind or stimulus of any kind. It's the craving for, as he put it, becoming. We want to become something. We want something to become the case. It's a kind of ongoing, subtle, leaning into the next moment, trying to make it be something, which has an implicit sense that there's something wrong with just letting the next moment be whatever it's going to become. All right? And then the third kind of craving is the craving for ending, for annihilation, the wish for personal death or non-existence, the craving for non-existence. And I'll get into those second and third kinds of craving a little later on in this series I'm doing, and I'm taking my time with it, for better or worse, hopefully for better, in terms of exploring this fundamental teaching of the Four Noble Truths. Okay? So for tonight then, looking at that first kind of craving that is a, if you will, an added reaction to events and the way they land in us. And to understand that kind of craving, it's important to understand what the Buddha called the three fundamental feeling tones, or in psychological language, hedonic tones of experience, as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So if you think about it, our experiences, things happen, right? They feel certain ways for us. The term is feeling tone, but it's not really about emotion. It's more about evaluation or the immediate sense of an experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And what happens then is that this, as it were, unnecessary but habitual response of craving adds a quality of greed or grasping to that which is pleasant, craving adds a quality of resistance or aversion or hatred, in the Buddhist traditional language, to that which is unpleasant, and to that which is neutral, there tends to be added a sense of grasping reaching for what's pleasant to make the neutral become pleasant. And wrapped around all that is a fundamental kind of delusion or ignorance. Okay, so we have the unpleasant, or I'll just do it this way. We have the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral. And that maps very well to modern psychological models that we approach rewards and we avoid harms. Right? This basic idea of approaching or avoiding, you know, as a way our psychology is organized. This is a motivational model. This is a model based on motivation, goals, wanting, drives, okay? Or another way of putting it is we try to promote the good and prevent the bad. Okay. So far, so familiar, all right? Additionally, in my view, as you probably know, I think there's a third fundamental motivation, the motivation to attach to others. And I think that, particularly in terms of the evolution of the brain stem, ancient, somewhat reptilian stage of evolution, and then the early mammalian stage of subcortical evolution with the thalamus and hippocampus, amygdala, and so forth, and then most recently, the real build-out of the cortex, which has essentially tripled in volume in the last several million years, that's very much associated with recent primate-human stage of evolution. As this has happened, I think there's been such an extraordinary development or movement in the centrality of relationships, certainly for primates and definitely for human beings, that it's meaningful to me to add a third fundamental motivational system to avoiding harms and approaching rewards, that system being attaching to others. And developing a framework like this that acknowledges the importance of our social needs, our interpersonal needs, for me gives a kind of flexibility and room to breathe somehow in Buddhist psychology that can feel a little too narrowed or reductionistic if everything boils down to pleasure, merely pleasure and pain, merely pleasant or unpleasant, approaching or avoiding, promoting or preventing. That's my own view. It's also consistent with the view of many others, including, for example, Stephen Porges thinking about polyvagal theory, in which the second most recent branch of the vagus nerve is very, very focused on what's called the social engagement system. As are other related systems in the brain, major neurotransmitter systems, our social relational needs are really fundamental. If you think about, I don't know about you, most of my joys and most of my sorrows don't have to do with kind of narrow pleasant or unpleasant or narrow harms or rewards. They really have to do mainly with the field of relationships. Now, any one of these systems can draw upon the others to serve its needs. In other words, we can avoid harms through approaching the rewards of getting enough money to, you know, buy a lock for our front door or move to a safer neighborhood, right? We can also approach rewards, right, through avoiding the harms of things like bankruptcy and ruining our credit. The whole point of these motivational systems, which use each other for their own purposes, is the fundamental aim. In the same way, the attaching to other system can draw upon more ancient, more fundamental reptilian and early mammalian systems that avoid harms or approach rewards. For example, in an interpersonal relationship, to support the aim of depth of intimacy, we might avoid harms of giving our partner cause to fear us. As the Buddha said, give no person cause to fear you. We can also support intimacy through avoiding harms of being misunderstood by being clear and real and open-hearted in how we communicate. We can also serve the goal of, let's say, greater intimacy in our relationship by approaching the reward of, for example, looking for what we could be grateful about or what could gladden our heart or what is lovable or likable in our partner. Okay, so far? This is kind of like a map. It's a model. Like any model, it's not so much true or false as useful or not. And see for yourself what you find here. Okay. So in this framework, then, we have this fundamental way of looking at things. We have that which is unpleasant, which activates the avoiding harm system, which can relate to what's unpleasant with tanha, craving, or chanda, wholesome wanting. Right? We have the pleasant feeling tone that the brain reacts to with its approaching rewards system, and that approaching system can shift into one of two modes, one of two settings. The craving setting or the wholesome desire setting. And we have, I think, a fourth feeling tone emerging, that which is heartfelt, that our brain can respond to with either craving or with wholesome desire. In other words, we can respond to what's unpleasant with either the craving of resisting, hatred, if you will, or we can respond to what's unpleasant with a quality of fundamental peace. We can respond to what's pleasant in terms of craving, in terms of grasping after it, what the Buddha called greed, or we can respond to the pleasant with wholesome desire, in other words, with a fundamental quality of contentment, already prior contentment. And we can respond to what's heartfelt with, I'll add a word here that the Buddha didn't use, heartache, with a kind of form of craving where we cling to, okay, others in ways that are problematic. Or we can respond to what's heartfelt with an already present sense of being loved and loving. Those are our choices fundamentally. That's the tipping point where we either tip into craving and thus suffering and harm for ourselves and others, or on that tipping point, we tip into wholesome desire, wholesome wanting, characterized by an overall quality of peace, contentment, and love in response to that which is unpleasant, pleasant, or heartfelt. That's kind of an overarching map that for me is really quite fundamental. And it sets up the key question, which I'll get to momentarily. So first of all, do you have any questions about this little roadmap, this framework? Just really? Okay, clear? So we have three kinds of feeling tones, right? Unpleasant, pleasant, and heartfelt. Three fundamental systems, avoiding harms, approaching rewards, and attaching to others. And the three fundamental options, you know, driven by either, you know, resisting, grasping, and clinging, right? Or fundamentally a quality of peace, contentment, and love. All right, that's our choice. Great. Rob.
Having a difficulty with wholesome desire,
yeah,
and craving.
Right.
And I'll give you the example of why, uh-huh, I'm having it today. I got an email from the head of the ambassador program at WildCare, and she wrote in there what she was doing to improve the life of a certain animal. Changing the design of the cage. That was my design. And I told her how to do it a couple days ago. She did not mention me in her email. Now, I would have liked to have been mentioned. So, am I craving acknowledgement, or is it wholesome desire to have a pleasant response to a significant improvement in an animal's life? Especially since everything I do, I don't get my normal rate. Right?
Yeah.
Zero.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a wonderful example, and I'll restate it for everybody, including for the recording, which gets posted more generally. What is the difference between craving and wholesome desire in response to a situation in which we've been mistreated, in which there's been a kind of injustice? On the global scale of injustice, it's not a 10. It's probably more like a 1 or a 2 or a 3, but it's a real one, right?
Can you speak up a bit?
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, it is. Well, thanks a lot, Mark, over there. So I was just saying, you know, this injustice is real. It's not a, 10, right? It's maybe a 1 or a 2 or a 3, but it's real, okay? So the question then is, at this tipping point, what is a response based on, since this I think of as a social issue, I put it in the attaching system, in terms of our three fundamental needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection, you know, which is a way of thinking about how we deal with what's unpleasant, pleasant, and heartfelt, safety, satisfaction, and connection. I think of this as an issue in the connection system, right? He's been uncredited. He's been ignored, as it were, unfairly, by someone who's in a position of authority, okay? So the question then becomes, you're exactly right, in the difference is, especially to the Buddha, and this takes me to where I wanted to go here, what is it about that which is full of heartache here, right? It doesn't feel good. What is it about that which is unpleasant, right? Or that which is pleasant. What is it about those things that conditions us into craving or wholesome desire? This is the key question. And in the Buddha's view, what it is ignorance or delusion. And what tips us into craving is the illusion, the delusion, or the ignorance that when events occur, there is a deficit or disturbance. In other words, in terms of that which is unpleasant, there is a violation of safety in a fundamental way that gets to the core. Or in terms of that which is pleasant, the delusion or ignorance is that there isn't enough right now at the core. And in terms of, let's say, an issue in the social system, our needs for connection, what creates craving, what creates clinging, if you will, in this case, clinging to what in psychology are called narcissistic supplies of recognition, prizing, inclusion, rapport, and so forth, what tips us into clinging there is a delusion or ignorance that there is a fundamental lack or deficit or disturbance in being loved enough and loving enough, if you think about it. If we operate on the basis in the moment of a sense of not feeling at our core loved and loving, in a situation like that, we will do what I have done in situations like that and tip into various forms of clinging and therefore craving and suffering and harm. Alternately, if we have an underlying felt sense of being loved enough and loving enough in our essence, we can then respond to this challenge, this mistreatment that's real. We can respond to it in a way that is honorable while simultaneously being protective and nurturing and championing of ourselves, much as we would a dear friend who was in our shoes. And that, to me, is all the difference in the world. Do we go to war with, or do we get all beseeching and reproachful toward the person who's wronged us? Or, on the other hand, do we have a wider view about what's happening? Are we able to put it in perspective because we feel already deeply resourced in terms of our normal narcissistic needs? And can we have compassion for the other person? Can we have compassion for ourselves? Can we give ourselves time to reflect, to prepare an appropriate response? And then when it's time to offer an appropriate response, can we do so while communicating with right speech, you know, operating with our code, with simultaneously a sense of healthy entitlement, healthy deserving, dignity, gravity, and realness? That's really the question. And what tips us one way or another in the Buddhist fundamental model is ignorance or wisdom. The root fundamentally of suffering, the causes of suffering in the Buddhist model is ignorance. That's why seeing clearly and wisdom is seen as that which undoes suffering. Just to read you something that will kind of, I think, get this across in a certain kind of way, the centrality of seeing clearly, right? We have a little saying from the Buddha. I'll do it like this. So this is a conversation. This is traditional kind of language. So this is a conversation in the early teachings of the Buddha between one of the Buddha's two main students, Sariputta, who is well known for his wisdom. And someone comes to Sariputta. I'll tell you the whole story. On one occasion, the Venerable Sariputta was staying in Magadha in Nalaka village. I always love it where they place these things. Then Jambukadika, the wanderer, this character, wandering renunciate, Jambukadika, a lot of the discourses have this form. A wanderer who is respected as a religious practitioner comes and asks the Buddha or one of his students a question. A respectful question, and then it goes from there. So Jambukadika, the wanderer, went to the Venerable Sariputta and on arrival exchanged courteous greetings with him. After this exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to Venerable Sariputta, "Suffering, suffering, it is said, my friend Sariputta, which type of suffering are they referring to?" And then Sariputta replies, "There are these three forms of suffering, my friend, the suffering of pain, the suffering of fabrication, and the suffering of change." Fabrication is the ongoing constructing of mental activity based on this subtle form of craving that I described as the second kind of craving, you know. And then there is this, the suffering of change, the fact that we try to hold on to things that are changing. That's kind of a side point. And then, then the wanderer asked him this question, but is there a path, Sariputta? Is there a practice for the full comprehension of these forms of suffering? And then Sariputta goes on to say, yes, there is a path that leads to the full comprehension of these forms of suffering. Note that key word. What's the key word there? Comprehension, understanding, penetrating insight. That's really seen as the vehicle of awakening, deep fundamental understanding. And there are things that are factors of understanding, like morality, moral conduct, restraint, concentration, the cultivation of mindfulness, the regulation of attention, managing ourselves with other people so as not to cause harm. Those are seen as supporting factors for that comprehension, that wisdom, that radically penetrating insight that utterly frees us from this whole mechanism. Meanwhile, in smaller ways, we can start seeing through the ignorance or the delusion that tips us into craving rather than wholesome desire in response to that which is unpleasant, pleasant, or heartfelt. And you can ask yourself these questions in everyday life, and then I want to see what you think about all this. All right? Here's the question. And you can start asking it even right now or in your meditation. You know, right now is, in terms of my core needs, our three fundamental needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection, that loosely link to the reptilian, mammalian, and primate stages of evolution. Safety, satisfaction, and connection. In terms of these core needs, in this moment, am I fundamentally safe? And in the answer to that question, based on wisdom rather than ignorance, based on comprehension rather than delusion, in the answer to that question, there can be a letting go of resisting or hatred to that which is unpleasant. In my core, in this moment, am I fundamentally safe? Variations on that are, in this moment, am I attacked? In this moment, am I threatened in my core? Like when the sounds rose outside, I asked myself in my own meditation, you know, am I safe in my core? Yeah, I don't need to go to war with those sounds. I don't need to fight them. They're unpleasant, let's say, mildly unpleasant, but I don't need to add insult to injury. Or a related question in terms of our needs for satisfaction, approaching rewards. In this moment, is there enough? Is there fundamentally enough? Be nice to have more, and still, in this moment, is there enough? If there is, and there usually is in truth, isn't there? You can let go of, I can let go of, that grasping, that greed, as the Buddha called it, for more. And we can also ask, in this moment, in terms of our core needs around connection, relationship, am I loved and loving? In my core, am I loved and loving? If the answer again is yes, with clear seeing, then again, there can be a letting go of clinging and heartache in this moment. So it's a practice in the moment that's characterized by clear seeing and letting go. As Ajahn Chah, the great Thai teacher, teacher of Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, and others, no longer alive, as you know, perhaps, Ajahn Chah said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go of a little resisting, a little grasping, and a little clinging, in other words, if you let go of a little craving, you'll have a little happiness. That's better than no happiness, all right? If you let go of a lot of resisting, grasping, and clinging, a lot of craving, you'll have a lot of happiness. And if you let go completely of grasping, right, or resisting, grasping, and clinging, if you let go completely of craving, you'll be completely happy. And that's our fundamental opportunity in everyday practice, again and again and again, both dealing with the moment and over time, because neurons that fire together wire together, gradually internalizing this understanding that in any given moment, most of the time, we are fundamentally already safe, satisfied, and connected. So there's no need for that craving that leads to suffering and harm. All right. What do you think about that? Michael.
So if we're fortunate enough to be able to bring wisdom or mindfulness to bear on this impulse that we have in dealing with a desire, I find a really powerful thing in the toolbox, really simple one, is to ask the question, does this desire serve us? Mm-hmm. So that if you have a desire for sustenance before you climb a mountain, yeah, that blood sugar is going to serve you. But if, as you mentioned in your recent book, if you're thinking about a second glass of wine, is the second glass of wine going to serve you in the same way that the first one would? Mm-hmm. And does something still serve you that maybe used to?
Right.
Really useful, easy way to kind of cut through.
That's great. Thank you. That's right. Great. Thank you, Michael.
So
great.
If it's true that the answer to those questions, which I agree with, is most of the time, yes, but then is it ignorance that leads us to believe it isn't so? In other words, on the day-to-day basis, if I could believe it all the time, then I'd be wouldn't suffer. But there's some part of me that doesn't believe that's true.
That's right.
And so that's, you know, a fundamental issue of, well, why don't I believe it? Is it because I can't see it, or?
It's a great question. I mean, so in terms of the progression, we haven't yet gotten to the part of practice. I'm doing various sort of nuggets or suggestions about practice along the way. But as you say, your understanding is that, yeah, in this moment, I'm fundamentally safe. In this moment, I'm fundamentally, there's enough. And in this moment, I'm loved and loving. In other words, there's no deficit or disturbance in this moment. You understand that.
Right.
But on the other hand, as you're saying, you also notice that, it's hard to sustain that comprehension,
right,
using Sariputta's word. Why is that? And that goes into a whole lot of considerations about both the brain's negativity bias and its tendency to overlearn experiences of deficit and disturbance, which we then transfer into current situations. We overgeneralize that overlearning of the negative into current situations, and we just kind of automatically presume a sense of threat level orange, or we automatically presume a sense of not enoughness or urgency around drivenness in terms of approaching rewards, you know, getting more that's pleasant. And we tend to presume routinely that, you know, we're not liked enough, or it'd be good to get more liking and so forth. I think that's one part of it. And that's why I think as we go into the third noble truth, which is where I'll be moving pretty soon, that's why, as you may know if you've checked out my book or other things I've done recently, I think there's a lot of value in repeatedly internalizing in a very emotional, body-centered kind of way the felt sense of being safe, satisfied, and connected. The felt sense in the moment that I really am in my core safe, I really am, there really is enough, and I really am, in my essence, loved and loving, right? Because that will gradually decondition these habit patterns that we've learned through life experiences that tip us into lots of unnecessary craving. Also, in terms of that, what I called auto-craving, that kind of delusional craving, through really taking it in to the marrow of our being, that we're fundamentally safe, satisfied, and connected, that can undo that second kind of craving, that ongoing craving for becoming, but that's a subtler form of craving. But meanwhile, what you can do in meditation or in life in general is just ask the question, in this moment, am I safe in my core? In this moment, is there fundamentally enough? You know, in this moment, am I loved and loving? And it's very, very powerful what the answer usually is. And it tends to cut through, you know, the delusion and the ignorance that leads to suffering and harm. It's very powerful. Yeah?
When you say it that way, am I safe in my core? What if you're not safe, like, bodily?
Then you're not, and you want to tell the truth about that. You know, that's a different kind of delusion. You know, if you're actually being attacked and someone's banging on you with a stick, and you're like, oh, I'm really safe. No, that's a delusion. So yeah, you do what you can. But what happens over time is people, particularly with practice, increasingly they're able to deal with very challenging situations even without losing that sense in the marrow of their being, in the essence of their being, that what really matters is actually not threatened. So, yeah. You may know the well-known story at this point of a monk, true story, came out of various prisons of the Chinese government in Tibet, finally got to northern India, was telling the Dalai Lama about 20 years of torture and mistreatment, essentially. And the Dalai Lama at one point said to this monk, were you not afraid for your life? Oh my goodness, all these things happening to you. Were you not afraid for your life? And the monk replied, well, the only time I was truly afraid for my life was when I felt like I was starting to lose my loving kindness and compassion for my captors. That's how he defined his own life in his core. And as long as that wasn't threatened, he was fundamentally safe in his core. Wow. Yeah. So I figure, wow, if you could pull that off, how come I'm getting all bent out of shape that someone has kind of been all snarky at me? You know. Okay, maybe another person or so. And again, I invite you to keep looking at this quite experientially. In the moment, do you feel safe? In the moment, does it feel like there's enough? In the moment, can you access a fundamental sense of being loved and loving? Yeah.
I just have to say, it just reminds me, I watched the movie on Nelson Mandela.
Ah, yeah.
And there were so many scenes, but one thing that I remember is the scene of him being in the prison camp digging. Yeah. And the reporters came to see him. And they couldn't talk to him, but they had shots of him in the prison camp. He looked so peaceful.
Yeah.
And he looked so, and it just, you know, it's just, that's where he was, what you're talking about. And it's just, it kind of just blew my mind thinking about it, because I know it's that same thing as being an animal. I mean, just the animal doesn't think about tomorrow.
Yeah.
They're just there, and how do you, I don't know. I think it's just, it's very attractive to me. I don't know, I'm not there, but I know at moments.
Yeah.
I guess it's just moment to moment.
Yeah.
That's all it can be.
Yeah, you're right. It's kind of how we respond to the situation. There's a Zen master whose name escapes me who was asked toward the end of his life, you know, if you could summarize, you know, what you've learned from 30, 40, 50, 60, 80 years of practice, what is it? He said, learning how to offer an appropriate response. Wow. Think of him boiling his whole life of practice down to learning how to offer an appropriate response, right? What Michael was saying as well. Yeah, that's really, really true. I want to end on time if I can, you know, kind of change my practice of being oh so late. So I just kind of want to offer, if I could, this sort of final suggestion for you in the week ahead is to recognize the ways in which that craving, by its very nature, in at least this model, is not inherent in conditions, right? We tend to presume, oh my goodness, I have to go to war with, I have to resist, I have to hate what's unpleasant. Well, is resisting, hating, or going to war with the unpleasant actually inherent in the unpleasant itself? Or is it something we add, right? Or, you know, we might sense, oh, something that's pleasant. I have to add grasping after it. I have to chase it, right? Well, is that actually inherent in what's pleasant? Or is this something we add? And then last, if there's something that's uncomfortable, some rejection, some narcissistic injury, some dismissal, et cetera, some loneliness in our relationships, do I have to add clinging to that? Do I have to add chasing after the person to that? Is that actually inherent in this experience of heartache here? I don't think so. And that gives us a kind of freedom to start realizing that, wait a second, things happen. It's not inherent that I add craving to them, because I can recognize with clear comprehension, with wisdom, the opposite of ignorance, I can recognize that in this moment, in my core, I'm fundamentally safe. In this moment, there really is enough. And in this moment, I actually am loved and loving. And that is a kind of profound freedom. So let's hang out with that for a minute and wrap it up. May you all comprehend clearly.
Rick, before you let everybody go, next week we should have recruited a couple of people to come and wash the dishes because we had to put the